Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high reaching up to 109. 105 is average for today. We topped out yesterday at 110. Partly cloudy skies for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 108. Slight chance of some rain in the afternoon. Same goes for Thursday with a high of 105. It is 109 degrees right now at KJZZ. Aetna has become the latest health insurer to retreat from the Affordable Care Act's public exchanges, and the decision will have a major impact in Arizona. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, the move leaves one county without a health care exchange plan under the Affordable Care Act.
Following the nation's third-largest health insurer's announcement that it would exit public exchanges in all but four states, Pinal County now does not have a company offering marketplace health insurance plans next year. Aetna was the only insurer planning to offer ACA plans in Pinal for 2017. It currently only sells in Maricopa, but it planned to expand. Blue Cross Blue Shield Arizona and United Healthcare currently cover about 8,500 people in Pinal, but United is pulling out of Arizona and Blue Cross is not offering plans there next year. Arizona Insurance Department spokesman Stephen Briggs says Blue Cross filings would allow it to offer Pinal County plans. A Blue Cross spokeswoman, though, had no immediate comment on whether the company might reconsider. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
The number of ballot measures Arizonans will decide this fall fell by one yesterday as backers of an initiative to cap the pay of hospital executives said they'd spend their resources elsewhere. Two other measures to increase the minimum wage and legalize marijuana are the subjects of pending lawsuits. For more on this, I'm joined by Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, first off, what happened with the hospital executive pay measure?
Well, the measure already had problems. There were challenges to the circulators in terms of whether they, in fact, were qualified to circulate petitions. And if the circulator is found to be disqualified, any of the names they've gathered, which could be 10, could be 100, could be 1,000, are also thrown out. That was in front of Judge Gerlach in Maricopa County Superior Court, and we were waiting on a ruling on that. I have a feeling that they sort of felt we were going to wind up short anyway, so let's come up with a cover story. And the cover story, if you will, is, you know, this election is so important that we really need to put all of our resources of the Service Employees International Union behind defeating Donald Trump rather than wasting our time with this. And so based on that, they withdrew their efforts to have their petition certified and no hospital pay measure on the ballot.
Now, we're also waiting to hear on rulings and lawsuits about two other measures on the ballot, including the one that would raise the state's minimum wage. And my understanding is some of the issues in front of the judge for the hospital executive pay were also dealing with the minimum wage issue, right?
In fact, many of the parties are the same. I mean, you've got the Chamber of Commerce and its attorney trying to kill the minimum wage measure because under the argument that $12 an hour is perhaps too much. Of course, it's sort of humorous that they didn't want to cap hospital executive pay at $216 an hour, but, you know, we'll do the math on that one later. But they still have that same problem. It's the same petition circulators, the same company that hired them. And so we're waiting on some rulings there as to whether they're going to throw some of those off the ballot. There's a there's also a parallel question of whether some of the counties in verifying individual signatures is being too aggressive, and that's going to be heard next week in Superior Court. The marijuana one is a whole different beast. The issue there isn't whether there were qualified circulators, but the argument by opponents that the measure is too complex and that the major provisions were not put into the 100-word summary that is required under the law. That, of course, brought a kind of humorous comment from Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Jolynn Gentry, who pointed out to the attorney challenging it, you know, it took you four pages to explain to me what isn't in the 100 words. So how do you expect this to happen?
That ruling also we're waiting on to determine whether that issue will be on the ballot. Howie, if let's say hypothetically that both of these measures are struck down, that would leave Arizonans with no initiatives on the ballot, right? I mean, and that hasn't happened in quite a while.
That hasn't happened in a long time. Originally, the legislature had put a measure on the ballot last year dealing with the funding of the land department, and then they sort of thought better of it and withdrew it this year. There were a whole number of initiatives that were started that were sort of abandoned along the way, and then these three sort of crossed the finish line. But it raises some interesting questions, because one of the issues every 2 years is, what initiatives cause people to come out? Will a measure on the minimum wage cause more Democrats to come out? Will a measure on legalizing marijuana cause more folks who are opposed to recreational use to come out? And without those, we're back to basically a clean election over the president, the U.S. Senate, and the Corporation Commission, as well as the local races.
That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
I'll be holding my breath for a marijuana ruling.
There's a political controversy brewing in the city of Surprise between the mayor and vice mayor. There could be some more clarity on this issue tonight when the council meets. With me to explain what's going on is Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau. And Matt, why is Vice Mayor Jim Biondo upset with Mayor Sharon Walcott?
Well, Mark, Walcott has campaigned for the opponents of the vice mayor and another sitting council member in the upcoming election. In doing so, the vice mayor, Jim Biondo, believes that she's violated some city policies and procedures.
She has every right to endorse. It's her legal right to endorse. But in doing so, she, under the auspices of the official title of mayor, she violated some city policies.
So who is Jim Biondo, the vice mayor of Surprise?
Well, Biondo's been on council for about 5 years now. Both times that he has been on there, he's been appointed. So this is actually the first time that he's running in an election. But even if he wins, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be vice mayor next year, because in Surprise, they choose their vice mayor every January.
Well, why is Mayor Walcott supporting Biondo's opponent and the opponents of some other city council members?
Well, Biondo says that the mayor hasn't told him why she's supporting his opposition. What he says is that she's made public comments saying that she feels like there needs to be new blood on the council. So Biondo has one opponent, and whoever gets 50% of the vote plus one by midnight on August 30th, they're going to be the new council person.
Well, what's Mayor Walcott saying about all this?
Mayor Walcott spoke through an attorney. She had the attorney send a letter to the city responding to the ethics complaint allegation. The letter basically says, you know, this is a First Amendment issue, and the mayor has the right to endorse whoever she likes. The letter also accuses Biondo of trying to silence a political opponent and control campaign speech.
Well, on that question, I mean, this is not something that's unusual with an elected office holder endorsing another candidate, even if it's not somebody who's currently in office. Is there anything particularly different about this case than what we see pretty much every election cycle?
That remains to be seen, because Biondo has declined to give specifics about the policy violations that he thinks have occurred. He says he'll give those tonight. There are three or four of them that he'll go through. He says that it's possible that city policy and procedures could conflict with the First Amendment.
I don't know whether it does or does not, whether our policies do or do not violate constitutional rights and freedom of speech. But until and unless that's adjudicated officially, then we raise our hands and swear that we will uphold the policies of the city of Surprise when we take office.
So, Matt, you referenced the council meeting tonight. What are we expecting to hear? What are the next potential steps here?
Well, like I said, Biondo says he's going to give specifics. He says there's three or four instances where he believes the mayor has violated city policy. I would expect the mayor will have a chance to respond, and then the council will vote on whether or not to have a special meeting to discuss these specific allegations.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey from the West Valley Bureau. Matt, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
The Navajo Nation filed a lawsuit in federal court today over a massive mine waste spill that tainted rivers in three western states last year. The blowout sent wastewater containing arsenic, lead, and other heavy metals into the Animas River. The lawsuit was filed against seven defendants. Tribal officials held a press event in Shiprock, New Mexico, to offer a few more details. I'm joined now by KJZZ senior field correspondent Carrie Young, who watched that conference. And Carrie, what was the general tone at this event?
Well, I will say I was not in Shiprock today, but I watched here via Periscope, and the tone, you could sense a lot of anger from many of the speakers. One of the first to take the podium was Navajo Nation President Russell Begay, and he said trust between the Navajo Nation and the EPA had deteriorated significantly. One of his biggest complaints was just a delay in some of the cleanup efforts, and also just that not enough compensation was coming down.
We want those farmers compensated now. We don't want EPA to wait until a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, and God forbid that it be 10 years down the road.
So, Carrie, there are seven defendants listed on this lawsuit. Can you tell us a bit more about who was included?
So listed first is the U.S. EPA, but the tribe is really aiming this legal action pretty much at everyone it considers responsible for the disaster. So also included are the contractors who were working that day with the EPA. The Gold King Mine Corporation was also listed. The argument there was that they didn't adequately reclaim the mine. They just kind of let it sit there once they had abandoned it. And then the owners of a nearby mine, the Sunnyside Mine, were also listed because they say it was the shifting of that wastewater that led to this blowout and breach to begin with. The tribe's attorney general says she hopes that by filing the lawsuit, they can avoid disasters like this in the future.
Now, Carrie, I know that representatives with Arizona Senator John McCain and New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich were also there. What did they have to say?
Right. So Senator McCain's chief of staff, Pablo Carrillo, took the podium towards the end of the press conference, and he said the senator is very supportive of the lawsuit.
He views it as an important compliment to the criminal referral that he sent to the Justice Department.
Also important to note from what Carrillo said was that there is a criminal investigation underway going on in the Justice Department right now over this event. Carrillo was one of the last to speak after we heard from the tribe's president and vice president and several farmers and tribal council members.
That's KJZZ's Carrie Young. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks, Mark.
The city of Mesa is investing a lot in redeveloping its downtown, but there's another part of town city leaders there have also spent years reinventing. Tonight, the city is holding a forum for community members to learn about the redevelopment area project in the Fiesta District. The show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, when I think of the Fiesta District, I think of the mall. So what are they turning it into?
So the goal is more of a business district. So Fiesta Mall and the area around it, which is near the US 60 and Alma School Road, used to be a real financial and retail hub for Mesa, but many of the big box stores that were there have closed over the years, and the area has really struggled. So I went there with Mesa's Vice Mayor Dennis Cavanaugh. We met at the new police substation there, and we talked about what used to be at that intersection, which is on the corner of Grove Avenue and Westwood.
What we're looking at is really what was Mesa's first power center, bringing together retailers like Best Buy, Cost Plus, CompUSA, Staples, and it was a very, very successful center. But over the years, with changing online retail sales particularly, a lot of these stores either closed entirely, downsized, moved to other locations. And so you're left with a center that was built like in 1985, and here in 2008 or so was totally vacant.
Since, the city has spent about $25 million in streetscape projects and infrastructure in the area, and their economic development department has worked to attract private companies to fill in some of those old empty buildings. So Cavanaugh walked me through some of the success stories they've had in this redevelopment over the years.
Just to the east of where we are here was the old Pearson Learning Center building that now has been completely redeveloped. It's now the corporate headquarters for National General Insurance, with over 500 employees. To the west of our location, we had the old Bed Bath & Beyond complex that has been redeveloped into the home of Santander Financial Services. It's really creating an interesting synergy because restaurants are following, and the hotels, they've all been doing major improvements because they've had increased business.
And now the area is about to get its first residential construction in more than 25 years.
So, Lauren, what's next?
So now the city's working to expand its redevelopment incentive area to include parts of this Fiesta District. And Cavanaugh says that's one of the tools the city can use to help the area thrive, as well as putting in new infrastructure that kind of lays the groundwork for future development.
It's like laying the tracks for a train. Only, today you've got to be very nimble when a user says, I'm going to have 1,000 employees here. Can you handle the water and wastewater needs for a business that size on this spot? And yes, we can.
Do you think that this can be sort of an example of what a city can do for an area?
No, I think it's a great example because unlike many states, Arizona has, we don't have a lot of tools for economic development. What cities can control is the look and feel of a place. We can control the infrastructure that is delivered to the space. We can create zoning codes for sustainable buildings, a form-based zoning. How does a building look in context with its neighborhood? How will it be, how can it be sustainable as uses may change inside it? How do the buildings relate to the street? How is it a walkable neighborhood, a biking neighborhood? This last year, we just unveiled our grid bike program, but the next place for expansion of bike stations will be here in the Fiesta District. Those are things that city can do to help connect dots through the grid bike, through designating transportation corridors, and in working with developers and not be averse to different kinds of development.
So you're leaving the council not too long from now. Do you hope that this is one of your legacies?
I really do. I've had the privilege of now serving on 4 terms on council, and we normally only can serve 2 4-year terms. I was lucky enough to come back. So you're able to work on a project long term. And so it's nice to see a project come to really a positive outcome, which started in crisis. Now, particularly that most of the street construction is almost completed and the barricades are down largely, a lot of people are seeing the vision of the feel and look of the place that we want. So it is something that is pretty gratifying, but you know, as cities go, it's always going to be a work in progress.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
More and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
My favorite thing about the ocean is the sound of the waves.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
Go to the beach and fly my kite and go on the boardwalk.
The more science we do, the bigger this problem appears.
If we don't conserve the oceans, it would be really terrible.
It'd be super heartbreaking.
Unfathomable to me.
It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
We know today that oceans are the ecosystem of last resort. You drop it, dump it, flush it, rinse it, drain it, even recycle it, and some of it ends up in the oceans. You can see the historical document of human, industrial, and consumer waste down through the ages by looking at the oceans. Old-style pull tabs, thick glass and plastic, old toys, styrofoam in every shape. How to clean it up? Plastics, litter, all sorts of debris that have polluted our water since the beginning of civilization. Could a robot come to the rescue here? Scientist Boyan Slott has designed a barrier that could collect and remove trash from the Pacific Ocean without disrupting marine life. The founder and CEO of the Ocean Cleanup came up with this idea to clean up the oceans while diving in Greece at just 16 years of age when he came across more plastic bags than fish. Since then, he's dedicated countless hours to the project. If all goes as planned, 22-year-old Slott and his team hope to collect almost half of the remnants in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which spans waters from the west coast of America to Japan. It's over 150 million pounds of trash. In just 10 years, Slott is currently testing his prototype in the North Sea, and it's pretty hard to miss.
It's sort of like a long floating curtain, which is about 5 feet above the water and 5 feet below the water, and acts like an artificial coastline there where there is no coastline. Ocean currents in the area, they rotate, so it doesn't stay in one spot. And we are basically making use of that movement to let the plastic hit the barrier. And because this barrier is in a V shape, the plastic gets pushed towards the center. And once in the center, it's so dense you can hardly see the water. And that's a spot where we can then easily take it out and store it before we ship it to land for recycling.
What's to say fish and wildlife and marine life won't get caught in this or decide to build homes in it or suddenly decide, you know, it doesn't care about plastic. This is a great place for me to, you know, lay my eggs.
Because we don't use any nets, we use these non-permeable screens. There really shouldn't be a reason why we would collect any sea life. The current would flow underneath these barriers, and that would take away all the neutrally buoyant material, including things like fish and plankton. And we actually have a prototype of our system here off the coast of the Netherlands right now. And also there, we didn't observe any negative interaction between sea life and the structure. So we expect that not to be a problem, but we will certainly continue to monitor it, because obviously the whole reason why we're doing this is because we want to solve a problem.
What waste would this miss? In other words, what future engineers will have to deal with the rest of the filth that we dump into the ocean?
So there are some pieces that are too small to be extracted, for sure. Our models now show that it's somewhere between about a tenth and half an inch, approximately. What we see is that when we go out there and we do these expeditions to really map the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, was that actually about 98% of the mass of the plastic is still in objects larger than that threshold, meaning that we can actually collect most of it.
And is there any way of disposing of this plastic that actually doesn't also hurt the environment?
We've shown that it's technically possible to recycle this ocean plastic. There are also applications for plastic that aren't by definition harmful. I don't think it would be a good idea to use this plastic to make, for example, new bottles or new plastic bags, because those objects have a high likelihood of entering the ocean again. But I think when you look at objects like car bumpers or chairs, things like that, that's a rather durable way of using plastic and storing it with a very small chance of entering the ocean, because that's not the type of objects that we come across in the middle of the ocean.
Isn't the ocean supposed to just take everything that we dish out? Isn't it kind of a natural system capable of rolling with the punches?
The unique thing about this is that the plastic is persistent, so it doesn't go away by itself. In the early days, a lot of the impact we had as humans, it was sort of temporal, and the stuff would disappear after a while by itself. Plastic is unique in the sense that it doesn't go away by itself, and actually, as we now see, becomes more harmful over time. And this is something that we only started using on a large scale in the 1950s. The consumption grew exponentially. And now that has the results that it has a side effect, which is that millions of tons of plastic enter the oceans each year.
Who was amazed by what you managed to do here? Because it occurs to me, and part of your motivation for this project is that nobody is cleaning up the ocean, that everyone just goes, oh, well, nothing we can do about that. And you've taken it upon yourself to really to go here. I would think there would be a number of skeptics involved in ocean cleaning, and you may have encountered them.
At first, there were certainly some people who were saying that it's impossible and that we should focus on prevention. Sometimes you still come across those arguments. I really think the only way to show that it can be done is to go out there and try it. And that's why we're doing this very iterative development program at this point in time.
If the best case scenario transpires here, what would you expect in the next 10 years?
In a few years from now, we'll be ready to start cleaning up the ocean. And then at some point in time, I also hope to do a bit of work on the prevention side as well. I think developing spin-off technologies of what we're doing in the ocean to also work, for example, closer to land or something, I think that can really complement and will get us to a future in which the oceans are clean again, perhaps within 10, 15 years from now.
Well, it's very optimistic and very ambitious and very Dutch, I would say. With a little American spice in there. Boyan Slat, thank you so much.
All right, no, thank you.
Boyan Slat is the creator of the Ocean Cleanup Array and CEO and founder of the Ocean Cleanup. It's a foundation dedicated to developing advanced technologies to rid the ocean of floating and distributed plastic.
Jeez. Welcome to the world of the plastic.
That's John Hockenberry at our partner program, The Takeaway. Private companies and local governments are forking over the cash needed to upgrade infrastructure and staff America's ports of entry in this absence of federal funding. The money is going to things like new inspection facilities and overtime pay for customs officers. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Monica Ortiz-Uribe reports the goal is to keep up with an increasing number of international travelers and trade.
A sure sign of a thriving port of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border is the number of street vendors peddling everything from water bottles to giant wooden crucifixes on the Mexican side. At the Santa Teresa border crossing in southern New Mexico, a woman plays the accordion while her young son collects tips from drivers waiting to enter the U.S. These commuter lanes are sandwiched between a set of cargo lanes where 500 commercial trucks cross daily. New Mexico's exports to neighboring Mexico are the fastest growing in the U.S. Their value has doubled since 2013.
The port is the heart and soul of everything we do here.
Jerry Pacheco is a businessman who's lobbied hard for industrial growth along New Mexico's southern border. But federal funds for port improvements have lagged behind commercial investment.
If we don't continue to focus on the port, we're not going to be competitive in the future.
As a result, the private sector has stepped in. This year, Dell, the computer maker, is coughing up at least $200,000 to staff a southbound cargo lane 4 extra hours a day. Why Dell? Well, if you own one of their computers, chances are it was assembled at a massive factory just a stone's throw from the steel border fence in Mexico.
They're making up to 55,000 Dell computers a day that are shipped everywhere in North America.
It takes 200 trucks to cross all those computers into the U.S. daily, making Dell the heaviest user of this port. The longer the border crossing stays open, the more product the company can move. Carl Laskus heads global trade for Dell.
This is an example of business and government coming together in a collaborative way. It costs nothing to taxpayers and yet provides a business-friendly solution.
This is possible thanks to the Reimbursable Services Program, which began as an experiment by U.S. Customs and Border Protection in 2013. Chris Sullivan is the director of alternative funding for CBP.
If a private entity is trying to perhaps increase business at an airport or get more commercial cargo through a port of entry, they can reimburse the government for our services.
But it's not just private companies that are investing in these projects. Cities, counties, and states are also investing. For example, the city of El Paso is collecting 50 cents extra in tolls at two of its border crossings to fully staff all lanes on weekdays. Other participants include seaports in Texas, Florida, and Pennsylvania, as well as airports like Phoenix Sky Harbor. By the end of this year, CBP expects to partner with a total of 58 different entities.
Public-private partnerships are the wave of the future, in my opinion, because we're just trying to do more with less.
The money can only go to reimburse CBP for overtime for existing officers, not to hire new ones. It can also go toward infrastructure, like additional cargo lanes. Sullivan says this year, CBP received 3 times more applications than the agency can accept. But why does CBP have to look for outside money to extend its services?
The rhetoric and the politics, and therefore the policy, has been dominated by security concerns.
That's U.S. Representative Beto O'Rourke of El Paso. He says Congress prefers to allocate funds toward preventing illegal traffic versus facilitating legitimate trade.
We are far past the point of diminishing returns on additional dollars spent. The rational response to that is to then direct resources towards your ports of entry, which generate jobs and economic activity and improve quality of life.
In the meantime, the Reimbursable Services Program has proven to be a successful alternative. According to CBP, it's helped reduce wait times at participating ports of entry by an average of 30%. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, El Paso.
Tempe is in the second year of a unique way to manage what goes into the city's sewers. It set up a grease cooperative, which recently won an award for innovation in local government. Here to talk about it is David McNeil. He manages the cooperative and is Tempe's environmental services manager. And David, is this different from how other cities are trying to handle this?
The thing that's similar between utilities nationwide and even worldwide is that we as sewer authorities regulate users of our sewer system. Among those users are restaurants. Clearly, the issue or the challenge with restaurant discharges to our sewer system is what we call fat, soils, and grease, or fog. Ultimately, every sewer system under the authority of the Clean Water Act regulates restaurants that discharge water, wastewater, to municipal sewer systems. And we require them to install infrastructure and to engage in cleaning and maintenance practices that effectively remove the grease from the sewer system.
So what is the cooperative exactly, and how does it work?
Well, the idea is this. We regulate 1,000 restaurants in Tempe, and those restaurants are required under our ordinances to conduct collectively over 7,000 maintenance events and waste removal events annually. That's a hard burden, regulatory burden to effectively manage, and it's kind of plagued industry-wide by a high non-compliance rate. One, because it's a lot. There are a lot of regulated events, and it's hard to keep on top of that many events. But more so, it's the fact that waste management at commercial facilities like restaurants is an activity that's required of the restaurant, but in practice, it's contracted out to a third-party waste vendor. Well, those third-party vendors are largely unregulated, and so there's kind of an accountability gap in terms of making sure that the activities are done using procedures that are compliant with our municipal requirement. So ultimately, what we found is a model, a business model that's used in the private sector. The idea is that we, as a regulatory agency, enter into a transaction and procure the compliance on behalf of the regulated entity. Well, that gets the city, that gets the sewer authority assurance through contract that it can manage the quality of the service that's being provided to the restaurants.
So does that make the city that third party that collects and disposes of the grease, or do you work with other third-party entities to do that?
Essentially, yes. What we do is we contract with third-party entities, the same vendors that are providing service directly to restaurants, but we contract with them directly instead, and we can monitor the quality of service. In addition, what we bring to our restaurant community is buying discounts. So our restaurants save 15% to 30% off of the cost of service that they would be able to obtain at a retail level.
How has it worked to have the city sort of getting in the middle of this transaction? Because I think for a lot of services, the trend seems to be cities sort of allowing private entities to handle it and not getting in the middle of it. In this case, the city is intentionally getting in the middle of this transaction in an effort to sort of improve the efficiency of it and improve the compliance of it. Is it working out?
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, the disconnect in this transaction, the way the transaction is conducted traditionally between a restaurant and a waste hauler is really an imperfect transaction in that the restaurateur, who is the expert in, pairing entrees and wines, does not know plumbing, does not know waste management. So they enter into a transaction with a waste hauler really not knowing and not having the skills and understanding to know whether or not they're getting the service that they're paying for. And what we do is we come in and instead of holding the restaurants accountable that service, we perfect the transaction with knowledge, first with the procurement process. We perfect the transaction with knowledge because now the city, as the customer, can review the work and make sure it's done correctly. And if it's not done correctly, we can hold those vendors accountable. So, yeah, it is not typical, and granted, it doesn't always work efficiently when the government gets involved in a transaction. But in this case, it's kind of a broken transaction or a transaction that is not traditionally conducted with perfect knowledge. And, when there's not perfect knowledge from the buyer's perspective, it's plagued with quality issues. And so we step in and we level the playing field.
David McNeil is Tempe's Environmental Services Manager and the manager of the city's Grease Cooperative. Last week, Discount Tire got some attention for its visual support of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's re-election campaign. Several Valley stores posted his signs that led to calls for a boycott against the company. So what are the considerations for a business that wants to express its political views? To help answer that question, I'm joined by Graham Wilson, a political science professor at Boston University. And Graham, what kinds of things do and should firms think about when deciding whether to go public with their political opinions?
Corporations get involved in politics for lots of different reasons. Sometimes they are trying to influence regulators because regulators can have a very powerful impact on their costs and their way of doing business. And sometimes they want to push for a general cause, such as restricting union rights or something along those lines. And sometimes there are people who own private corporations who just want to get out there and make a statement.
How much do those companies have to think about, well, I wonder what my customers will think about this?
In this day and age, corporations, businesses generally worry a great deal about the brand. And they particularly worry about the brand image if they sell to consumers. So if you're selling to consumers and there's an alternative available, then you listen and you care about what your political image is going to be. If you're making steel that somebody else rolls out and makes into a product, if you're making a chemical used to make something else, and you're not really dealing with consumers, you're dealing with other businesses, then, hey, maybe you don't have to worry as much.
Is there a difference when a company is taking a stand on an issue that affects it directly? You referenced Nike and working conditions or maybe union membership and organizing versus supporting or opposing a specific political candidate, as in the case of a Discount Tire here in Arizona, which has been putting up signs supporting Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio?
That is a really interesting example that you've given me, and it's particularly interesting because it goes against what I was saying, right? There are plenty of places to, plenty of different brands of automobile tire that you can buy, and I would guess that that is either the sentiment of the owner or they're thinking that there's a market they can tap of non-Hispanic people who might like the sheriff. But that is a really surprising example.
It seems like this is sort of drawing a contrast between the First Amendment rights of a business owner, right? They can obviously say whatever they want and within reason, of course, and support whichever candidate they want. But it seems like now it would be easier to do that sort of behind the scenes, whether it be campaign contributions or some other kind of behind the scenes support, as opposed to coming out publicly and saying, yes, I support this candidate, or no, I don't support this candidate or this particular issue.
Right. Well, businesses have, in a sense, long supported candidates, but fairly discreetly through the political action committee system that was set up in the early 1970s after Watergate. But you're absolutely right. There are plenty of ways of very discreetly getting money to candidates, and you don't have to stand up there and make a really big statement. I'm backing this particular candidate. You can funnel the money through foundations to super PACs and onto the individual candidate. And that way, you don't have to worry about damaging the brand or adverse reaction.
Yeah, I mean, do you think this is just a matter of the company saying, look, we support this guy so much, we don't really care what potential customers or actual customers think about our support of him. We're going to come out and say it because, hey, we have the right to do it, and this is what we believe in.
That sounds as though you've got it absolutely right. And I would just go on to say that, you know, if you think about some of the other celebrated people very active in politics with privately owned businesses like the Koch brothers, generally they're not in the business of dealing direct with consumers. And so it is really a remarkable statement of support for this candidate for a corporation to come out and adopt such a strong position for such a controversial politician.
Graham Wilson is a professor of political science at Boston University. We are talking about the pros and cons of businesses expressing political views. Let's say you're looking for a place to go to dinner, or maybe a swimming school or a moving company. You might go to Yelp and check out what people who've used those services have to say about them, right? Well, Yelp certainly hopes so, but the company has had to deal with some reviews that weren't written just for informational purposes. Yelp this year announced some companies, including a few in Arizona, have been offering incentives to reviewers. That's a no-no, and Yelp is trying to get the word out about this. With me to talk about this is Ruth Carter. She's an attorney focused on business intellectual property and social media law. And Ruth, if you're an online company, how important is it for users to believe your reviews are legit?
Well, the whole purpose of sites like especially Yelp, but even Amazon, is to provide a forum for users and customers to talk about the products and services they've purchased. So if people can't trust that those reviews are accurate, then that whole component of the site becomes valueless.
So what is Yelp trying to do about this? Because my understanding is that there have been some instances recently, including with some companies here in Arizona, where there has been some sort of shenanigans going on with the reviews.
I think since Yelp came into existence, they've had to worry about false reviews or companies either asking their employees to create false positive reviews or false negative reviews about their competition. So one thing they have in place is the ability to report when you think a review is in violation of those rules, that you must be accurate and truthful and that you're actually a customer.
How would a user know that? Like if I'm looking for a restaurant on Yelp, how would I have any idea if a review is not what it appears to be, which is legitimate?
It can be hard to tell the difference. One thing I do enjoy about Amazon is when they have the verified user or verified purchase on the review. So you can actually, there's actually a link between the purchase and the reviewer, at least through the same account. When it comes to Yelp reviews, I take it with a grain of salt. So you have to look at, is this, how many reviews has this person made? How many people are they connected to? What are their other reviews? And then look at the content of the review itself. Are there photographs? Does it sound like the person was actually there versus somebody scripting something in advance just for the purpose of posting it?
In your mind, is Yelp doing a good enough job of trying to weed out reviews that have been posted by people who are compensated by companies or who, you know, just have an axe to grind?
That's really hard to say because federal rule requires people to only post accurate reviews and truthful reviews. And if you are being compensated, you have to disclose that or else you could face a fine. So now Yelp isn't going to get fined if somebody's posting bad reviews, but they do a pretty good job from what I can tell. This is just an outsider looking in by at least giving the opportunity for someone to report a review as potentially false or spam or something of that effect.
When you are a consumer, what are some of the things that you should be looking for? You referenced this a little bit earlier, but are there specific things that people should be looking for to determine whether or not this is a review they should trust?
That's a really hard question because if you want a trusted review, go to somebody you trust. And then maybe you use reviews by strangers as a way to fill in the blanks or provide some of the details to what you want to know. Another thing that's great about Amazon is you have the opportunity to post a question about a product. Again, you never know who's going to answer it and if they have a type of bias, but hopefully that gives you the opportunity to do your homework before you purchase a product.
In your mind, how big of a problem is it of people posting reviews that are not actually legitimate?
I guess that depends on how you define problem. I know that there are violations of the FTC rules regarding review sites and reviews that require you to be accurate and truthful and always disclose when you have a relationship. I know violations like that happen all the time. So from a company's perspective, could they be setting themselves up for reputational damages and a hefty fine from the FTC? Yes. From a consumer perspective, I think if you apply common sense and buyer beware, as an individual, you're probably going to be okay. It's more about the companies who have to worry about the bigger pains of breaking these rules.
Ruth Carter is an attorney here in Phoenix specializing in intellectual property law. Ruth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's be honest, alleys do not have the world's best reputation. The concept of a back alley anything, not good. We're often hoping not to meet someone in a dark alley. But cities across the country and around the world are trying to make better use of their alleys and turn them into urban hotspots. And in Phoenix, where some people see fear and darkness, others see possibility.
If I could take a time-lapse video of what a normal day would look like, you would see hundreds of people actually using the alley. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice if this thing was cleaned up?
Pete Salas owns Barsmith and the Monarch Theater in downtown Phoenix. The clubs back up onto an alley between 1st and 2nd Streets and Washington and Adams. Salas says he and his neighbors got together and started talking about ways to fix up the alley. In city speak, they wanted to activate it. One of the people they reached out to was Ryan Tempest, an architect and co-founder of the group This Could Be Phoenix.
If we can show to enough people what a good alley looks like and, you know, the benefits of having an activated alley, I think that enough people will get on board that, you know, we can start to really change things and have some momentum on it.
Tempest and others have dubbed this Phoenix Alley of the Arts. Many of its walls are covered by murals. But there are a number of other things they'd like to do. Replace the many dumpsters with a few trash compactors, even out the surface, improve the lighting, just become a place people want to check out rather than avoid.
A lot of times alleys are shaded, so you can really activate them to be these places where, you know, pedestrians can cut through and get away. They can also be activated in ways where you've got businesses that are opening up the back of their storefronts to the alley and having seating. They can just be a place where you're just sitting to get away from, you know, or go on your lunch break or something like that.
Tempest says he thinks businesses could open up to the alleys and sell stuff. Restaurants on either end of the alley could put seating back there. Pete Salas says that wasn't something he'd thought about, but believes it could benefit businesses that back up to alleys.
It brings an electricity to the city of doing things that you hear happen in large cities around the world and maybe in L.A. or New York.
Maybe give Phoenix a little more cachet?
Exactly.
A few miles north of Phoenix Alley of the Arts, another alley is undergoing a makeover.
So we are looking right now at an alley. It's right off of Camelback and Central, and it's an alley that was in some pretty rough shape. There was a lot of graffiti. There was a building that I understand had some drug activity, and the residents and the merchants came together and they said, we want to do something. We want to activate this alley.
Michael Hammett is Phoenix's chief service officer. He helped coordinate the cleanup of this alley with the help of nearby residents and business owners and AmeriCorps Vista volunteers. This alley is a little different than the one downtown since there are homes adjacent to it rather than just businesses. But Hammett says the goal is pretty similar.
We're hearing that they want it to be a gathering space where there could be events back there, especially at night when the city vehicles aren't coming through the alley. There could be, pop-up events. It could be merchant-led. It could be resident-led. And we heard that some are interested in seeing benches where people could sit and rest under shade.
Hammett says active alleys are safer alleys. He thinks this one could be a way to connect residents and businesses. It could also serve as a thoroughfare that people can use rather than walk right along Camelback.
Trying to get people to walk those distances is greatly enhanced when you have interesting things for them to see along the way.
Alan Stevenson is Phoenix's planning and development director. His department is in the process of finalizing a formal alley activation program. He says the idea grew from downtown, and that's where the effort will focus. He doesn't see this as widespread throughout the city.
This is really a fine-grained effort to keep some of that artistic vitality and some unique places that really are the fine-grained details of downtown that help create that overall character that promotes people wanting to walk to these different areas.
Stevenson says alley activations have to balance the desire to clean the alleys up and make them more interesting spaces with their practical purposes, trash pickup and utility connections among them. He says historically, alleys were places to be avoided and only serve those utilitarian purposes.
Now in Phoenix and a lot of other large cities across the country are looking at how you can reuse those areas to provide, you know, a lot of interesting artwork, some cool little spaces to activate those, even if they're on a temporary basis.
Stevenson says people wanting to fix up the alleys will be responsible for paying to do it. Pete Salas says right now the biggest investment is time and effort, but he's ready for what's next.
We don't have all the prices, but we've already started doing things that we can do. You know, $20 here, donated pots here. I promise to water all the plants with Bar Smith and Monarch's water, which we don't mind. You know, everyone's going to have to give up something for civic pride.
Phoenix is working to finish the regulations for its formal alley activation program and plans to take them to a city council subcommittee in September. The full council should take them up and approve them later this fall. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.